The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro. Continued, Cassette 10, Side 1. In this second campaign, they had multiplied their illegalities, and if Lyndon Johnson lost, who would be their friend in power? Who was to be their friend with federal regulatory agencies, such as the Interstate Commerce Commission, whose jurisdiction included their Joe D. Hughes Trucking Company, or the Federal Power Commission, whose jurisdiction included their big and little inch pipelines? They, Brown and Root, were regulated in 1,000 ways, says Clark, Brown and Root's attorney and lobbyist. And if Stevenson became senator, Stevenson would have run them out of Washington. He would say, if anyone wanted to give them a contract, they're personally objectionable to me. The Browns had to win this. They had to win this. Stevenson was a man of vengeance, and he would have run them out of Washington. Johnson, if he lost, he was going back to being nobody. They were going back to being nobody. That, second primary, that was when the chips were down. That was the acid test. That was it, all or nothing. Therefore, Ed Clark explains, whatever he, Johnson, needed was available to him. Some of this financing was handled through the younger men who would collect it in cash from Herman Brown or Wesley West in Houston, or Sid Richardson on St. Joseph Island, or Clint Murchison and Amon Carter in Fort Worth, or from big oil independents such as Harris Malasky and Taylor. Asked how much money was involved, John Connolly smiles and says, a hell of a lot. I'd go get it. Walter Jenkins would get it. Woody would go get it. We had a lot of people who would go get it and deliver it. I went to see Harris Malasky 3 or 4 times. I handled inordinate amounts of cash. Connolly says he can make no estimate of the amount of cash spent during the single month of August 1948, but some idea of the scale emerges from an anecdote told by Charles Herring, the young Looney and Clark associate and former Johnson congressional aide who had been seconded to Connolly for the campaign. No matter how fast the cash came into Connolly, Herring says, it went out at the same rate, and the telephone company, whose bill had not been paid, was threatening to cut off phone service. One evening, Connolly told Herring, I can get currency in Houston, but I've got to get it tonight. A private plane would take him to Houston, and he asked Herring to meet him at the Austin Municipal Airport on his return. When Connolly arrived at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, he was carrying a brown paper sack like you buy groceries in. Inside, Herring says, was $50,000 in $100 bills. After counting it, the two young attorneys decided to stop for a snack at the Longhorn Cafe, an all-night diner. As they were driving home, Herring recalls, Connolly suddenly snapped his fingers and said, where's that sack? We had left it in the restaurant. Any bum off the street could have picked it up. But when they ran into the cafe, the brown bag was still there. When asked whether the $50,000 represented a substantial part of the cash spent in the primary, Herring looked astonished. That didn't touch what you're talking about, he said. On another occasion during August, Herring says, Connolly returned from a trip to Houston with $40,000 in cash, took it home and hid it, and forgot where it was. For 2 or 3 days, we couldn't find it. Connolly thought the money must have been in a suit that had been sent to the cleaners, but no trace of it could be found. Herring said, maybe we'd better tell Johnson. But Connolly, cool as ever in a crisis, never panicked and told his assistant to tell nobody. And, says Herring, we didn't tell anybody about it, except every cleaner in town. Finally, the cash was found inside a shirt in Connolly's shirt drawer. Asked about these two incidents, Connolly says only with a grin, I told you I've handled inordinate amounts of cash. Wilton Woods says that in 1941 he once carried $25,000 in cash from Herman Brown to Alvin Wirtz. During the 1948 campaign, he said he made several trips carrying that amount or more. This immense supply of campaign financing meant that Liz Carpenter's story on Coke Stevenson's Washington press conferences, including the erroneous implication that Stevenson had not made a previous statement, could be printed not just as an article in the newspapers that employed her, but in many of the 60 daily and 488 weekly newspapers in Texas as an impressive advertisement with the headline, Exact Washington Interview of Stevenson Dodging Issues. Her article rolled off presses not just on newsprint, but on the glossy paper of brochures sent out in direct mailings, and in excerpted form, on penny postcards sent in repeated mailings so that the average Texas family would be able to see the name Stevenson connected with dodging over and over again. Some days after the press conference, Drew Pearson's column appeared with the keyword used twice in the lead. Ex-Governor Coke Stevenson of Texas, on a recent trip to Washington, evaded more issues and dodged more questions than any recent performer in a city noted for question dodging. That column was reprinted, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of copies were sent to voters in repeated mailings. Most important, the story of the press conference was repeated over and over on the radio. Johnson repeated it in his speeches, of course. These speeches were written by Paul Bolton. Describing what he wrote, Bolton says, "Repeat the same thing over and over and over, jumping on Coke Stevenson's having secret dealings with labor. You knew it was a damned lie, but you just repeated it and repeated it and repeated it. Repetition, that was the thing." Johnson had respected and influential politicians repeat the lie in radio speeches broadcast in areas where they were known. For example, Longview newspaper publisher Carl Estes, a power in East Texas, delivered a speech written by Wirtz and his speechwriters that was heard throughout his part of the state. Hailing Johnson's outspoken championship of the Taft-Hartley law during the fight for its passage in Washington 2 years before, a statement which would have surprised anyone who had been in Washington, Estes said, "Mind you, the same labor bosses which Lyndon Johnson helped to force into the raiment of Americanism are now down here in free Texas, using Coke Stevenson as a willing whip with which to punish this courageous congressman at the ballot box. If Lyndon Johnson is defeated, every CIO, PAC, AFL labor boss in the country will hail the victory, Operation Texas, and the march of decentralized industry to Texas, I warn you, will stop, while calculating Coke calmly lights his pipe." Pleased with Estes's delivery of the speech, Wirtz ordered it rebroadcast over a 20-station statewide network and reprinted in full-page advertisements in the state's leading newspapers. As for his own stand on Taft-Hartley, Johnson said, "My record on that bill has been made. I frankly stated it to the voters. I said my attitude toward amending it would be determined by the recommendations of a joint committee of Congress set up to study the law in action. I said I would consider any recommendations of the committee except one. On one section of the law, my opinion will not be changed. That's the section which requires the head of any labor union who seeks advantage under the Act to file an affidavit that he's not a communist or a member of the Communist Party. I believe that every person and every organization doing business with the government should be required to take a solemn oath that they are not communists." If this was something less than a firm endorsement of the Act, if indeed it was no less equivocal than Stevenson's position, no reporter pointed it out. Indeed, a reporter wrote it. Marshall McNeil was quite proud of his authorship of the Johnson speech. Stevenson, still defiantly refusing to reply to an opponent's charge, did not point it out either. Even if he had, his reply might have been lost. Lyndon Johnson had 1 month to make Texas believe that Coke Stevenson was a secret supporter of big city labor racketeers and had made a secret deal to repeal the sacred Taft-Hartley Act. And during this month, Texans were told this by letter, postcard, telephone calls from banks of phone workers, pamphlets, direct mailings, radio advertisements and speeches, by ads in weekly newspapers, and by articles in the weeklies that were in reality also written in Johnson headquarters. The charge was drummed into voters by the shouts of the scores of paid stump speakers Johnson had dispatched to crisscross the state. Special attention was given to the conservative businessmen who played so influential a role in Texas politics, and who had for years been Stevenson's supporters. Transcripts of the Washington interview were mailed, with individually typed letters, to hundreds if not thousands of responsible businessmen. Such a campaign cost a vast amount of money, but Lyndon Johnson had it. And it wasn't only the shouts, but the whispers. One of the little publicized factors of rural Texas politics was the men known variously as missionaries, or travelers, or walking delegates, or active campaigners. These were men influential with a particular ethnic group. For example, "You'd hire some popular Czech to go talk to the Czechs," one veteran of Texas politics says, "or simply an individual well known in some remote rural district." Such men were for hire in every campaign. "You'd send a guy out to see the lay of the land," B.B. Hardiman explains. "He would walk around the streets, try to find out who was for who, go to the courthouse, and they would talk around, spreading the rumors that their employer wanted spread." The missionaries were an effective political weapon, particularly in rural areas where voters were unsophisticated, uneducated, and accustomed to relying on word of mouth for information. The missionaries knew what to say. From previous campaigns, they knew what people wanted to hear and who to talk to. Never in the history of Texas politics had these missionaries been deployed on the scale on which the Johnson campaign was deploying them. A lot of the cash that came in those brown paper bags went to the walking delegates. Asked, for example, how the $50,000 that Connolly brought back from Houston was spent, Charles Herring says, "I saw him spend it. I saw him give it out. Our travelers would come by and pick up money." The Johnson campaign had between 50 and 100 such delegates out on the road during the second primary, and they each received between $25 and $50 a day plus expenses. Tens of thousands of dollars were thus spent to disseminate rumors about Coke Stevenson. Connolly says the active campaigners were employed to go around and spread propaganda. "We'd contact a guy and give him walking money, to buy beers, that kind of thing. He'd just circulate, dropping these little tidbits. He'd go from beer joint to beer joint and go into the courthouses. He was a local guy, and no one would suspect he was employed in the campaign." And with their money, the rumor mongers got their marching orders. Says Connolly, "We'd give them a party line. Did you hear Coke's not taking a stand on Taft-Hartley? Well, hell, he can't take a stand, you know. He made this deal." "Well, no, he didn't say it publicly, but he said it to a lot of people in Austin when he didn't think anyone could hear, and one of them told me." This whispering campaign was carried on not only by these travelers, of course. The rumors were spread by the thousands of federally paid employees of the state's 29 Rural Electrification Administration cooperatives and of the Department of Agriculture's Soil Conservation Service, and by employees of the Lower Colorado River Authority. The whispers were very effective. "It was working," Boyette says. "These guys knew what to say. Lyndon had created the doubt. He'll vote to repeal that act." The great danger for Lyndon Johnson was that his opponent would reply to the questions about his stand on Taft-Hartley, for Johnson knew what the reply would be. The Johnson strategists knew the truth about the charges they were making. They knew that Coke was really in favor of the bill they were claiming he was against. And if Coke simply said he was in favor of the bill, the issue would vanish, and with it any hope for a Johnson victory. So Johnson, confident now that if someone demanded that Stevenson do something, Stevenson would refuse, demanded again and again that Stevenson reply, in terms that he knew would make it even harder for Stevenson to reply. Calling the former governor pussy-footing and fence-straddling, he said in a typical speech, "Let's clear out the underbrush. The issue is plain. Has my opponent been gagged by the labor dictators? I challenge him to lift either his left leg or his right leg off the rail and get off one side or the other. Now is his chance to come clean with the people of Texas. It is his last chance." And as a further device to keep Stevenson from stating that he was for Taft-Hartley, Johnson now also predicted that the former governor would state that, for the basest of motives. "It would be a peculiar circumstance if at this late date he should now decide he is in favor of the Taft-Hartley bill," Johnson said. Stevenson would be doing so, Johnson said, only because he had realized that his true feelings were costing him votes. The use of this tactic, too, was escalated from day to day. Under a headline that read, "Like a branded steer, Johnson says foe to back Taft-Hartley," Hobby's Houston Post reported that Stevenson will actually endorse the Taft-Hartley bill before the second primary in an attempt to deceive voters. Charging that Stevenson had tried to be all things to all men, Johnson said that his own attacks on Stevenson's refusal to take a stand would force him to take one. Comparing the former governor to a freshly branded West Texas steer who tries to rub his brand off, the brand in this case being that of the state AFL, Johnson said, "If you folks will just stay with me, we will have him trying to get the AFL brand off his left hip before this campaign is over." Stevenson did not reply for 2 weeks, during which Johnson's tactics had their effect. Speechwriter Paul Bolton, who says Johnson's speeches were false, says also that the speeches were working. "You watched Johnson's ratings go up those weeks in the polls," says Busby, a brilliant political analyst and strategist. At the point at which Coke, in his Washington press conference, made the Taft-Hartley statement, at this point he, Johnson, had no leverage to get back into the race. But the minute I saw Liz Carpenter's article, I said, "This is our chance." When Stevenson made his notes reply, that was all we needed, John Connolly says. Johnson had an issue. Mr. Stevenson's strength came from his appearance of being a very solid, stable, thoughtful man, and a man who was above politics. Now, he looked indecisive, he looked vacillating, and he looked political, which was destroying his image. Stevenson's image was being destroyed even among the conservative businessmen who had known Coke Stevenson well, and who should therefore have been immune to the poison being circulated about his secret dealings with labor. Many of these men lived in Dallas, which, in Busby's phrase, was kind of the de facto headquarters of the right-to-work movement in America. Their concern was both ideological, Dallas, as Busby says, had a singular number of businessmen who believed America had to be protected from labor unions. And personal, for militant unionization in Texas would have adversely affected their pocketbooks. The main concern of the big Dallas businessmen, the employers, was not to let unions take over the labor force in Texas. And they were just shocked to their toenails by this interview, or to be more precise, by Liz Carpenter's account of it. These businessmen read Stevenson's interview, and Johnson's advertisements and statements reminding them of the interview, and concluded that Coke was making a secret deal with the unions. Stevenson's little band of aides also knew almost immediately the effect that his refusal to answer Leslie Carpenter's questions would have among these conservatives, and their suspicions were confirmed by a telephone call. One evening, just after Stevenson's return from Washington, the telephone rang in his hotel room while Ernest Boyette was present. On the line was Scott Schreiner of Kerrville, whom Boyette describes as a lifelong friend of Coke's. Schreiner had a question. "Well, Coke, how do you stand on Taft-Hartley?" To an old friend, Coke had no objection to reply. "Well, everyone knows where I stand. I'm not going to vote to repeal it." Boyette heard the reply, but he also recognized in the words, "everyone knows where I stand," a disaster for the campaign, for he understood the true significance of the telephone call. "Even an old friend was starting to have doubts," he says. "Lyndon had planted doubts in the conservatives' minds about the old man. He'll vote to repeal the Taft-Hartley Act." But his boss still didn't understand, Boyette realized. He still felt that it was not necessary for him to reply. And indeed, when Boyette and others attempted to persuade Stevenson to say in public what he had said on the telephone, the one magic sentence, "I'm not going to vote to repeal it," that could have neutralized Johnson's tactics, the answer was the same as it had been for 3 months now. "I'm not getting into a cuss fight with Lyndon." "I would ask him to make a public statement every time I saw him," Boyette recalls with a sad smile. "He was just such a strong-willed person." Exacerbating the reactionary's doubts was a human consideration. Haters of Roosevelt and his New Deal, indeed in Busby's words, of everything Roosevelt stood for, they hated Johnson as a New Dealer. But when they saw Stevenson waver, they hated him worse than Johnson. To suspect that a former friend has betrayed you is worse than an enemy opposing you, and therefore they got very angry at Coke. The mistrust of Stevenson that Johnson had created among conservative businessmen increased Stevenson's difficulties, because these businessmen were, of course, the source of most of his campaign funds. Immediately after the first primary, Stevenson's campaign manager had sent out letters soliciting contributions for the second race. But from some longtime supporters, including certain big contributors, that, Boyette says, we had always counted on, there was no reply. The checks that others sent in were often a zero short. "People who we thought would come in for $1,000 or $2,000 would come in for only $100 or $200, Boyette recalls. As a result, he says, we had quite a bit less than we had expected. Boyette understood why. "Lyndon created the doubt. He'll vote to repeal that act." It cut the flow down to a dribble. Moreover, Boyette explains, it wasn't just money we lost, but support. For the men who were no longer supporting Stevenson were the owners and managers of corporations. In those days, if a popular executive with a company let it be known he was supporting a candidate, a lot of the employees would go along. Now some of the companies we had expected to support us weren't. But the money aspect was crucial in itself. We didn't have adequate funds to conduct a campaign. It took Coke Stevenson 2 weeks to realize the damage that the Taft-Hartley issue had done to the reputation he cherished. "We didn't have any polls," Boyette recalled. "The old man didn't understand what it was doing to him." But calls from longtime supporters like Schreiner made him realize at last, and on August 11th, Stevenson issued a statement on Taft-Hartley. He made it in a letter to a friend, Sam Braswell, Jr., publisher of the Kerrville Times. "Sam," the letter said, "my stand on the Taft-Hartley law has never been a secret, although everything I have said regarding it has been deliberately misconstrued by my opponent in this race. I have said repeatedly in public statements and radio addresses that I think the effect of the Taft-Hartley law in curbing the labor monopoly has been a good thing for the country. I believe that you are sufficiently familiar with my public record to know that I have never kowtowed to any labor boss." The Dallas News commented that Stevenson's letter proved that Johnson's campaign has been largely waged against a straw man, for the letter expresses the view that the Taft-Hartley Act has been of national benefit in curbing labor monopoly, the only real purpose at which it was aimed. The charge has always been a little absurd, the News said, since to anyone familiar with his, Stevenson's, long record in Texas administration, obviously the accusation sought to portray him in a light utterly out of character. Koch himself pointed out that his statement was nothing new, it is a restatement of what I said in Abilene, but his aides were pleased that he had finally made it. His letter would lay to rest once and for all Lyndon Johnson's accusations, they felt, and the News expressed the same opinion, which demonstrated only that they didn't know Lyndon Johnson. He received the News in the midst of a day campaigning in San Antonio. He had to make 3 speeches in person that day and 3 over the radio, and to meet privately with the tough little postmaster, Dan Quill, and leaders of the city machine, and with the Mexican-American leaders who hadn't delivered for him in the first primary, and in between these speeches and meetings he shook hands in a park and at the city zoo, at the gates to industrial plants, with the workers crowding out at the end of their shifts, in downtown department stores, and in the teeming Mexican-American ghetto of the West Side. Towering above swarthy men in bright-colored shirts and old women in black rebozos, he abrazoed his way enthusiastically through the crowded, pushcart-jammed San Antonio slums. Up one business block and down another, apparently unmindful of the more than 100-degree temperature, the congressman moved, hugging, smiling, shouting, in a swirl of aides and voters. One by one, reporters retired in defeat to the air-conditioned comfort of their hotel before the day was very old. Johnson went on hour after hour. But amid that turmoil and heat, the amazing political machine in Lyndon Johnson's mind never stopped clicking away. By mid-morning, he had devised a strategy to combat Stevenson's letter. First, he called in friendly reporters and planted doubts in their minds about the letter's authenticity. He understood there was some question about whether Koch had really written that letter, he told them. They'd better make sure he had before they got too excited about it. Didn't it seem strange to them that after all these weeks of refusing to make a statement, Stevenson had finally made one in a letter to the publisher of some obscure small-town newspaper instead of in a speech or press release? Had anyone seen the signature? 2 friendly reporters, Charles K. Boatner of Amon Carter's Fort Worth Star-Telegram and Robert B. Johnson of Hobby's Houston Post, drove the 50 miles to Kerrville, and the Houston reporter confirmed that the letter was on stationery of the Stevenson headquarters at Austin and bore a signature which looked similar to the several signatures of the former governor I have seen. But Johnson's tactic caused some newspapers to delay publication of the letter a day and to give it smaller play than they would have on a first-day story, and it also clouded the letter just enough so that in some large papers it never received the major coverage it deserved. Robert Johnson's article, for example, said only that the letter purported to give Stevenson's view. But the main reason that Stevenson's letter had little impact was that Stevenson had little money. Now that the old man had made his statement, Murphy and Boyette and his other aides wanted it reprinted and broadcast. But printings and broadcasts cost money. Lyndon Johnson, who had money, countered the letter with a barrage of broadcasts. On both August 13th and 14th, he delivered 3 separate 15-minute radio talks, each over a 30-station network that brought his voice into every town in Texas. The line he took was that Stevenson was still dodging the issue. Stevenson's letter, Johnson said, was noncommittal. Texans think he has had plenty of time to give them a yes or no answer on whether he thinks Taft-Hartley is a good or bad law, and whether he would vote to repeal it. Stevenson was still behaving like a frightened politician, Johnson said. My opponent seems to be mighty interested in convincing the public he is not tied in with any labor bosses. Last June he accepted their endorsement with boasts, but under fire now from the other side he acts like he's ashamed of labor support and is trying to rub off the brand. To reinforce its candidates' statements, the Johnson campaign put on the air public figures respected in their various locales and put them on in an effective way, often purchasing simultaneous time on every radio station, no matter how small, in an area so that listeners could not avoid the Johnson pitch. New reprints of the press conference articles were made, and new mailings went out. On August 15th, Johnson, in another radio address, said, "By this time, nearly everybody in Texas has been forced to the conclusion that my opponent has established a world's record for refusing to declare his opinion on important issues." And indeed, the impression in Texas still remained that Stevenson had entered into some kind of deal with labor bosses. The ex-governor's letter had been buried as completely as his earlier statement in Abilene. The Dallas News was to comment on Johnson's tactics, With utterly unfounded allegation, incapable of substantiation, he has striven to connect the AFL endorsement with a non-existent deal to repeal the Taft-Hartley Act. But the tactics had worked. Johnson had not merely striven to connect the endorsement with a deal, he had succeeded in doing so. Turning the truth on its head, he had made a state believe not merely a lie, but a lie which defied logic. Texas had known Coke Stevenson's view about union bosses, but Lyndon Johnson was persuading a state that Stevenson's view was the precise opposite of what it really was. The magnification of the power of money in the new media politics made such persuasion relatively easy. A substantial number of voters in Texas did not subscribe to a daily newspaper, and since many weekly newspapers never carried Stevenson's letter, these voters never read it. All they knew about it was what Lyndon Johnson told them. Few voters in Texas read the text of the letter more than once. They read and heard Johnson's interpretation of it over and over. Against an opponent who had so little money himself, this persuasion had, in fact, been easy. As John Connolly is happy to explain, you have to say something over and over to get voters to be aware of it. And he, Coke, didn't do that. He didn't advertise it, he didn't make an issue of it on the radio. So the press might be aware of the letter, they might write a story about it, but nobody knew about it. In a final touch of irony, in Washington, the presidents of four railroad unions endorsed Lyndon Johnson for senator. Stevenson said, "This development is no surprise to Texans who are familiar with the real issues in this race and with the past records of both candidates." But most Texans did not learn about the endorsement. There were few broadcasts and almost no mailings to drum home to voters that the supposedly anti-labor candidate had been endorsed by labor. Asked about the difference in the candidates' positions on Taft-Hartley, Jeff Hickman, executive secretary of the state CIO, told a reporter that there was no difference. "The position of both candidates on the Taft-Hartley law is substantially the same. Both of them think it is a good law." But this statement was not even printed in many of the state's newspapers and was buried in those that did use it. Nor, of course, were voters or businessmen aware that Robert Oliver, organizing director for the Congress of Industrial Organizations in Texas, was quietly lining up a number of local CIO unions in Texas cities to support Johnson, or that Welly Hopkins, general counsel of the United Mine Workers, whose president, John L. Lewis, was being assailed by Johnson in his noontime radio broadcasts, was drumming up labor support for Johnson and carrying campaign material back and forth between Corcoran and Rowe in Washington and Wirtz in Texas, or that a major source of funding for Johnson's anti-union campaign was David Dubinsky and other big city union bosses, that in fact unions in cities throughout the Northeast were shipping cash south to help the Johnson campaign. In almost every speech now, Johnson was reading the transcript of the press conference in which Stevenson had refused to answer the questions about Taft-Hartley. The fact that Stevenson now had answered was all but drowned out in the flood of Johnson broadcasts, ads, and pamphlets. Money could buy more than publicity. Money could buy men. George Petty's votes were essential to any hope of victory, and Petty's stronghold was in deep East Texas, the little towns in the piney woods along the Louisiana border, the stronghold not only of Petty's strength, but of Stevenson's strength, of a conservatism as rock-solid as the Confederate state that deep East Texas so closely resembled. Johnson opened his second primary campaign there, in the very heart of Petty country, in Center, county seat of Petty's native Shelby County. In some ways, it was a traditional East Texas rally, with farmers and their wives sitting on backless benches in the courthouse square near the inevitable statue of the Confederate soldier, others remaining in their cars behind the benches and honking their horns to join in the applause. But the evidence of what money, unlimited money, could accomplish in even a hostile area was visible. As the Houston Post commented the next day, "His, Johnson's, bid for votes in this section is obviously going to be a strong one. Trees alongside the East Texas roads are decorated with his picture. His headquarters telephoned everyone in the Center phone book to get them out for the speech." Advertisements announcing the rally had not appeared merely in Shelby County newspapers or on Shelby County radio stations, but all over East Texas, and the crowd, 400 to 500 persons, larger than anyone had expected, had come from as far away as Bowie County, 105 miles to the north, to hear Johnson praise the native son in a bellow delivered over a full-size microphone strapped to his chest with a harness so that he could move around as he spoke. "I have not and will not speak an unkind word about Colonel Petty. He was a man I liked and admired. Colonel Petty and I agreed on almost all the issues of the race. But it wasn't Johnson's shouts that most strongly influenced Deep East Texas. It was the whispers of the missionaries. They had always had an unusually strong impact in these isolated little towns, so cut off from news of the outside world. Because of the affection for Petty in these towns, the active campaigners were instructed to make the colonel's friends believe that Stevenson was his enemy. "Well, you know, I was in Austin the other night in the Driscoll, and Coke came in, and you should have heard what he said about Colonel Petty. He said..." Did the Johnson campaign buy more than missionaries? At this crucial moment, according to men in both camps, Brown and Root swung into action in East Texas with local subcontractors. The power of small-town banks, on which local farmers are continuously dependent not only for mortgages and for refinancing of mortgages if they have had a bad year, but for annual crop loans and loans to purchase seed, was mobilized. Federal agencies with whom Johnson had influence, the Rural Electrification Administration in particular, used their influence in East Texas. And were more direct payments being made? Ed Clark, raised in San Augustine and still owner of a home there, was asked in later years how Johnson did so well in San Augustine and throughout East Texas. Clark, forthcoming on other points, will not discuss his home county. For reply, he only raised a big hand and rubbed his thumb and forefinger together. 40 years later, Ernest Boyette still vividly remembers his shock when he began contacting East Texas political leaders whose support of Coke Stevenson he had considered certain. "Almost the first two I contacted, and they were key men, said to me that they couldn't support Coke this time. I was so startled that words failed me. They had supported the old man for years. But they said that they had been offered $1,000 each to switch to Johnson. $1,000 was a great deal of money for them. I remember one of them saying that he was getting older and he had to leave something for his wife." Well, what could I say to that? They said they still believed in Coke, but that they would be throwing their weight to Linden. Into Stevenson's headquarters poured similar reports. Boyette recalls his thoughts. "My God, they're stealing East Texas." Similar tactics were being employed in rural counties all over Texas. The impressions of a score of politicians who remember the 1948 campaign are summarized in the reminiscences of a man who had the gift of grasping the overall patterns in the Texas political scene, Ralph Yarborough, United States Senator from 1957 to 1970. He, Johnson, had to turn it around against the establishment. The old establishment had more of the infrastructure in these rural counties than Johnson did. The sheriffs, the county judges, the tax assessors. But they, Johnson and the Brown Building Group, turned it around between the two primaries. They were able to do it so fast because of money. You can create a new structure fast if you have unlimited money. And they did. They were spending money like mad. They were spending money like Texas had never seen. And they did it not only so big, but so openly. Nothing had ever been seen in Texas on such a scale, and they were utterly brash. They spent a lot of money, and they were brash about how they spent it, and they were utterly ruthless. Brown and Root would do anything. They did it so big and so openly and so brashly and so ruthlessly because they knew they didn't have a chance by conventional political methods. Coke Stevenson had that race sewed up. And they did it because they knew they had more at stake. They had an awful lot at stake. For 4 months now, ever since May, Lyndon Johnson and his money man Herman Brown and Alvin Wirtz had been trying to buy a state. They hadn't succeeded, so now they simply raised their offer to levels like Texas had never seen. Coke Stevenson wasn't organizing the rural counties. During the first 2 weeks in August, he campaigned as he had always campaigned, driving around the state, shaking hands, talking to handfuls of voters about principles and the need for economy and common sense in government. The pro-Stevenson officials in these counties, legislators and former legislators, county judges, men who were part of the traditional Texas political structure, were left to their own devices. There was almost no communication between them and Stevenson's Austin headquarters. Some of these men were actively working for Stevenson in the weeks before the second primary, and some were not. Some, in fact, weren't even in the state. Well-to-do Texans tried to escape the August heat by scheduling their vacations for that month. Many of Coke's lead men had been planning to go hunting in Canada. When they offered to stay home if they were needed, Coke's headquarters didn't make them feel they were needed. Nothing illustrates the lack of central coordination in the Stevenson campaign more clearly than the situation in two remote counties, Kinney and Hansford. These two Stevenson strongholds had given the former governor a combined plurality of 400 votes in the first primary. Because Stevenson was so far ahead, officials of these two counties felt the ex-governor would not need their votes in the second primary, so they weren't holding one. And Stevenson headquarters was unaware of this fact. The overconfidence in Stevenson's headquarters was understandable. They were 70,000 votes ahead, and how could they possibly lose the petty vote? By all the ordinary rules of Texas politics, their candidate had won. But Johnson wasn't playing by these rules. From the earliest beginnings of Lyndon Johnson's political life, from his days at college when he had captured control of campus politics, his tactics had consistently revealed a pragmatism and a cynicism that had no discernible limits. His morality was the morality of the ballot box, a morality in which nothing matters but victory and any maneuver that leads to victory is justified, a morality that was amorality. Johnson had already enjoyed considerable success in linking Coke Stevenson, adamant foe of organized labor though he was, with big city labor racketeers. Now he was to attempt to link the former governor with another group, communists. Coke Stevenson, Lyndon Johnson now charged, was a front man for a communist conspiracy. Maybe Coke was an unwitting front man, Johnson said, and maybe he wasn't. Johnson began this effort in a series of radio broadcasts over statewide hookups that read into Stevenson's alleged failure to take a stand on Taft-Hartley a more sinister interpretation than any he had yet suggested. Lyndon Johnson voted for the anti-communist Taft-Hartley law, Johnson said. Lyndon Johnson will never vote to repeal this law. But my opponent has not yet made a public statement as to just where he stands on this measure that bans communist control of labor unions. The next evening, Johnson escalated the attack. Birds of a feather, such as John L. Lewis, James C. Petrillo, and communist Harry Bridges, whom I voted to deport to Australia years ago, have flocked together in a united effort to defeat Lyndon Johnson, who refused to wear their red feathers in his hat, and they are using Coke Stevenson as their silent man Friday. My opponent has refused to promise that he will not return control of labor unions to racketeering communist leaders who take orders only from Moscow. By the following evening, he was implying that Stevenson's refusal to promise might mean that he had made a secret promise. Does it mean that he will amend the law so that labor bosses could have secret communist connections? Johnson seemed to think he could make Texans, at least rural Texans, swallow even so ridiculous a charge if it was repeated often enough. To reinforce his speeches, which were making Stevenson's communist link more and more explicit, a new device was unveiled, aimed squarely at unsophisticated farmers. It was the inspiration of John Connolly, who says that when he was a farm boy in Wilson County, "My first impression of politics in Texas was the Ferguson Forum, a simulated weekly newspaper printed during the campaigns of Governor Jim Ferguson." People were all talking about it, Connolly recalls. It went into every rural mailbox. Most of these rural people read it, and they believed it. Pappy O'Daniel had copied the forum in his O'Daniel News. Now Connolly ordered up the Johnson Journal, a four-page newspaper written in Johnson headquarters but designed to look like a genuine weekly, so that to the unsophisticated it would carry a newspaper's authority. And it was mailed early in August to 340,000 rural mailboxes. The journal's theme was captured in its lead headline, "Communists Favor Coke." Also reinforcing Johnson's speeches, of course, was the other campaign device that had proven so effective with unsophisticated voters. From the Hancock House, new marching orders were given to the missionaries. To fan out across Texas, calling on farm families, standing around in grocery stores, sitting in bars, dropping hints and innuendos about Coke and the Reds. I'm not saying he is one, but listen. Assiduously, though he had, for years, privately cultivated Texas's wealthy reactionaries, Lyndon Johnson had always sought, for strategic reasons it was true, but nonetheless he had sought, to preserve a measure of independence in his dealings with them. While he had run their errands and accepted their cash, he had kept a little distance between himself and them, partly because he never wanted to be allied completely with any position, partly so that he could claim to the Washington liberals that he was liberal at heart. But now this was to change. The reactionaries' alliance with Coke Stevenson had always been tenuous. The former governor, although in agreement on ideology, had always been too independent for their taste, too proud, not nearly subservient enough. not subservient at all, in fact. Richardson and Murchison and other members of their circle had assured them that Lyndon Johnson could get things done for them in Washington, and that Johnson was not in reality the liberal he appeared to be. But before the first primary, they had continued to give their support, their money, their influence over the votes of their employees, to Stevenson. Now, however, feeling betrayed by Koch, he'll vote to repeal that act, they were more disposed to give it to Johnson. But prudent, practical men that they were, and determined to exact the complete subservience of the candidate who received that support, they put a price on it. The price was that Lyndon Johnson should give a certain speech. It was a speech not unfamiliar to Texas voters. They had, in fact, heard versions of it hundreds of times, delivered by W. Leo Daniel. For years, first as an announcer for Light Crust Flour and then for his own Hillbilly Flour, O'Daniel had exerted an immense influence over rural Texas through the radio talks he gave every day at a half hour past noon over the dominant Texas State Quality Network, talks that were almost sermons about motherhood and religion and beautiful, beautiful Texas, delivered against a background of soft violins playing sentimental country and western tunes, in the matchlessly warm, soft but firm voice of a wise and wonderful pappy. At 12:30 sharp every day, one reporter wrote, silence reigned in the state of Texas, broken only by mountain music and the dulcet voice of W. Lee O'Daniel. Even after Pappy's entrance into politics, he still spoke in the same time slot, but the speech was different. It had in its many versions the same basic themes, which played on the fears and prejudices of the unsophisticated and poorly educated listeners sitting over lunch on their farms and ranches. Its main theme was the danger from communists, who, Pappy said, had infiltrated Texas industrial plants and, along with racketeers, goons, and mobsters from the big cities of the Northeast, the state's labor unions. A genius in demagoguery, he would reiterate certain phrases. Communist labor leader racketeers, union thugs, and after a labor incident in Chicago in which a hand grenade was thrown, pineapple-throwing red goons. Over and over. Attempting to describe the speech, Pappy's speech, as it came to be known in Texas political circles, one observer recalls, he would just drum, drum, drum with his little catchphrases. Labor leader racketeers, communist labor leader racketeers, pineapple throwing labor leader racketeers. You just wouldn't think there would be that many ways to get labor leader racketeers into a sentence. Pappy's speech embodied the ignorant and vicious side of Texas conservatism. It was the essence of everything that Lyndon Johnson had convinced his liberal friends in Washington he was fighting against in Texas. Indeed, during his 1941 campaign against O'Daniel, he had had Pappy's speech recorded and sent to Washington to convince Corcoran and Roe, and Franklin Roosevelt, for whom they played the record, that Johnson's opponent was a Neanderthal and that therefore their support of Johnson's candidacy should be increased. This device had worked. Says Roe, that speech was the most unbelievable thing I ever heard. When liberal or moderate Texans gave their reasons for despising Pass the Biscuits Pappy O'Daniel, and they despised him quite deeply, they often did so by quoting Pappy's speech. Because the 12:30 slot on the Texas Quality Network had become identified with O'Daniel, and because farm and ranch families had grown accustomed not only to listening to it, but to believing what was said on it, that time slot was, recalls Horace Busby, the great prize in Texas politics. It was controlled by a group of Dallas reactionaries and was not available to any liberal politician, or indeed to any politician who refused to tug his forelock to them. When an unapproved candidate tried to buy the time, the network simply said it was not for sale. Early in August 1948, Attorney General Tom Clark's brother Robert, a Dallas lawyer who represented the men who controlled that time slot, approached Lyndon Johnson with a simple proposal. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.